I do encourage you to read ahead because only by reading ahead can you really soak up, you're really ready to kind of think together as a team and be aware. And so I encourage you to read ahead. If you would read chapter 7 and chapter 8 several times this week, that'll give us a good prep for a good start for next Sunday morning. So 7, 8, Lord willing, next week. All right?
All right.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thank both of you.
What?
I said thank both of you. All right. That'd be nice. Go ahead. I salute you, Larry. I shared with you a couple weeks ago that private revelations can be used by Satan. In chapter 4 of the book of Job, Eliphaz has a private revelation that I think Satan is directly from Satan. And by the way, all the reasons I believe that are in this book. So if you want a copy of the book, they're available in the bookstore, and so those are all here in that book. So that you can go over that if you wish to on your own time. We covered that a couple weeks ago. I was with a fellow gentleman this last week on Wednesday, and we sat down. He's painting a member's house, and he began to talk about that he had been told by 3 or 4 different people, independent of each other, "Oh, God has a great ministry for you." And so he's been waiting for this great ministry to come, and he's disillusioned because the promises that these Arminian type, emotional type, charismatic type believers, precious as they are, had made that they were trusting God would make good on, God has not made good on. So here's this guy who's kind of disillusioned. And it comes from, some of these word of wisdom and this word of knowledge and a word of prophecy and some of these things that really sound kind of neat. I'd like to have a word from God. I'd like to get an email. I mean, that's fine. God knows my email, We'd all like that, wouldn't we? I'd like to have a hotline to heaven. We all would. But the impact has been really overwhelming in this guy's life. He's frustrated. He doesn't want to paint houses, but that's what he's doing for a living, And again, I just repeat, private revelations can get us in trouble. And do we realize... Are we thinking, are we conscious of some of the motivation for that? Some of the motivation of a man like John Wimber, for example, is to recapture the authenticity and the vitality and the liveliness and the excitement of the first century church, which, we'd like that too, But how many times can you start the church?
What?
How many times can you have the apostles who are the foundation of the church? How many foundations do you need? You need them up 20 centuries later or 15 centuries later or 23 centuries later? I mean, how many times do we have to do this, Yes, Tony?
I just want to say that, we came out of that type of movement and theology, and what you're describing we saw over and over again. People that obviously didn't have a gift to do something, but, "Oh, God told me you're going to do this," and they're discouraged and defeated. Many have walked away from the faith. It's really dangerous and satanic. Sorry to say that.
Thank you, Tony. So part of the motivation for some of this is that they want to recapture the vitality of the first century church. Very understandable. But also part of the motivation for this is this awesome reality. And stick this in your hearts, please. The human heart longs for security. It longs for certainty. We want to know. We want to be sure of a relationship with the living God. And the whole Arminian viewpoint is that we cannot know. We cannot be certain. We cannot be secure. We cannot be eternally secure, forever secure. Eternal, the doctrine of what we, from our perspective, would call the doctrine of eternal security, being secure forever. What God did, I can't undo. If I didn't save me, I can't lose me, And that's a whole different subject. I won't get into it. But let me suggest this. Part of the motivation for the charismatic movement is that if we don't, it's to get what they cannot get in their theology to get in their experience. If my theology won't let me believe that I can be eternally secure, but oh, if I have this experience, which is very desirable. I mean, who doesn't like to stick their finger in a spiritual electric socket and feel just the charge, you know, and levitate, you know? I mean, I would like that, and I don't mean to be mocking or anything. I would like that. You would like that. But you see, if I speak in a tongue that I haven't studied, if I'm going to be a missionary in India and I don't have to study the language, I think that'd be pretty cool myself. I mean, I'd like that. I've struggled with Hebrew and I've struggled with Greek. And believe me, the language chromosome got left out on this model, you know? So I'd like to have an experience. The temptation is to find through your experiences these words of wisdom and these special things from God that maybe others don't know. There's an appeal to pride in this thing. You know, I know this and you don't know it, so you know, I need to tell you this, you see. And so I'm sure many of these people are very sincere, but the effect is, you know, Tony, the effect is this young man that I met this past week who's sitting around waiting for this great ministry to come along. Okay. We need to move along, so let's do that. We are in danger of crowning any experience with the same authority that we give the scriptures. Eliphaz spoke and he kind of felt there was very little else to say, and it became his dream revelation at the end of chapter 4 became the yardstick by which others are measured. And then I suggested, secondly, that human kindness is a part of satanic warfare. Satan is not for you. He is not for you. And he can use human unkindness. This morning, I was visiting with a couple from our church. Her boss is gay, not the end of the world. We love these people. We want to try to help them. We want to introduce them to Christ. That's just one of their sins, just like you and I are sinners. But he's very complaining, very dominating, very unhappy individual, and he has been very unkind to everybody in the office, and the whole office has teamed up against him. Some of you work in situations that are very difficult. You have people around you, above you, below you, beside you, that are caustic and unappreciative and demanding and self-oriented. Again, human unkindness is a part of spiritual warfare. Okay. Well, let's move along here now, we are in Job chapter 5. Job chapter 5. I want to read you just in each chapter that I come to, I've written a little big print here thing. So I just, it's better for you if I just read it. In Job chapter 4, Eliphaz stated his simple philosophy: what you sow, you reap. Since you're reaping suffering, Job, we can backtrack and be sure that you've sown sin. In chapter 5, Eliphaz spoke from the personal observation. Although evil people, Job, appear to be doing well, it isn't long before they get their due. Not about to compromise himself by admitting to the falsehood of his friend's accusations, Job hung tough. From Eliphaz's viewpoint, that left him to do only one thing. He could cry. Oh, I didn't have a title. Oh, yeah. Job, you can cry if you want to. You want to cry? I mean, hey, come on. So we're in Job chapter 5. Call if you will. Job 5:1. Who's going to answer you? Nobody's going to answer you, Job. You know, and like you're complaining. To which of the holy ones will you turn? Resentment kills a fool, Job. Watch your attitude. I sense a little bit of irritation here in your voice. It's inevitable, Job, that sinning people suffer. Come on now. Clean it up here. I myself have seen a fool taking root. Suddenly his house is cursed. His children are far from him in safety, crushed in court without a defender. The hungry eat his harvest, taking it from among the thorns. And the thirsty pant after his wealth, for hardship does not spring from the soil, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. Yet man is born of trouble as surely as sparks fly upward. Job, what's happening to you is not, just your laws of physics make sparks go up. You know, this thing is by design, Job. It's your fault. You're suffering, and I'm sorry, but you know, you got to change this thing. You're the problem, and you got to change. I suggested a week or so ago, and it's just so critical that I've got to go over it again for some who were not here last week on the holiday weekend. Why are these people so caustic to Job? Because Job has been a member of the good old boys club. He's been one of them. He knows the theology. He knows that the theology they've had in this good old boys club has kept the poor poor and the rich rich and provided a philosophical framework for the status quo because they like the status quo. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, Eli, Bilphar, love the status quo. This thing's going good for us here, and we don't want anybody to rock the boat.
That's right.
And then all of a sudden, here's this guy who's been a member of the club, Job, and all of a sudden he's suffering. And man, if this happens to him, now we can't explain this. We got a hole in our theology here. We gotta do something. What's the deal? They make the difficult decision of throwing him under the bus to preserve their comfortable theology, their status quo. And so this is the reason that there's not one word of human kindness to Job. Oh, Job, your kids, 10 kids, you're all dead. Oh, Job, you got hurt, you're a painful boy. Not one word of human sympathy for the friend Job. Why? Because he's a threat to them. And if they can't explain him, they got a huge problem. Because if it happens to him, it might happen to them. Which, of course, is not acceptable. Okay? We're in a very tight, wealthy fraternity of the blessed to maintain the status quo. And so Eliphaz is doing that here. Let's see. Oh, after a while, Job, verse 4. Yeah, guy can do pretty well for a while. But then his children are crushed in court. And the hungry consume his harvest. A hardship doesn't spring from the soil, Job. I mean, there's weeds that spring from the soil, but, you know, this thing is by design. Nor does trouble sprout from the ground. You know, this is by design here. So he's simply saying that it's inevitable that sinning people suffer. Okay? Okay? I've been talking too much here. I'm starting to preach. Okay, we got to move on. Unless you have a comment. Yes.
These friends of Job, they frighten these people who believe they have arrived at all the knowledge that they need. But yet they have ignored the fact that God, they have something to teach them. Yes. They set themselves up at the highest level.
You are segueing me perfectly into verse 8. Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, Richard. But if it were I, verse 8, if it was me, I'd pray, Joe. It's too bad for you that you can't get up where I am because, you know, I pray about things and I'm cool. Yes, sir. Okay.
It makes me think about,
thank you, Bert.
In the scriptures, we know that complaining, wouldn't it, when the Israelites were complaining all the time to Moses and had a real hard time with what was going on, mm-hmm. and God didn't appreciate that. But then I see in the Psalms, I guess my question is it okay for us to complain to God as long as we're not complaining about God? Can we take our complaint to him directly and that would have been okay?
You hear the question back there, Gary?
Yeah.
Okay. And your response is, excellent question. We've all been there. You're asking the question for all of us. Response. I'm sorry?
I said, my thinking has always been, you can ask inquisitively, but not accusatively.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Yes, Mike.
One way I've always liked to put it is, I believe you can ask God anything. You just can't demand that he answer to you all.
Okay. Good. Vince is next.
What is there to complain about?
Okay. Thank you, Vince. Yes, Bert.
David had a lot to complain about. And he wasn't asking. He wasn't always asking. Sometimes he was just questioning. Sometimes bitterness. Sometimes frustration, somebody said. Even sometimes anger. Mm-hmm. He was expressing his heart to God. Mm-hmm. He was opening his heart to God.
Yes. Yeah. Marta? I love that. Psalms 103. Yeah. Awesome. Yes. There's a hand over here, I think. Patty?
God knows what we're thinking already. We might as well verbalize it, get it off our chest, and confess it.
That's right.
Right? Because we're thinking it.
Yeah, he does. He always thinks before we think. Yes. Two, and then we got to move on.
So
Joyce?
Personal experience, when the Lord took my brother home, I was mad. I was angry. Really, God? Because I was praying for you to take my dad, not my brother.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't stay in that anger phase with God about that.
It's very interesting in 2 Samuel when Ahiah and Uzzah touched the ark, you know, it was moving, and the ark fell off and it broke. And God struck him dead, you remember? The text says that David was both angry and fearful. I think we've had those emotions. Last comment.
Just quickly, God wants us to love in every way for every reason. And if it takes your troubles, he says, come to me. It's the fellowship he wants. He created us to fellowship with him. Mm-hmm. So under any circumstance, we should go to him in joy or in need.
I would agree with the comment that who said Bridget, your comment was not accusative but
inquisitive.
I think that captures the chance. Yeah. Okay, let's see here, where are we? Verse 8, thank you. Yeah, segue. Yeah, Richard, segue. Okay, I got to get back to being facetious here and sarcastic and so forth in verse 8. If it was me, Job, I would lay my cause before him. I would appeal to God. I'd pray. Too bad for you, Job, that you're not up where I am. And, here's the what I would do if I were in your shoes problem. What I would do if the scenario was reversed and I was the one, facing these kinds of things. It's very interesting. He sounds quite self-righteous, and he makes it very clear this is not by accident, not random, not illogical, and we've all done this. We have given out advice painlessly, and then a few years later, we're the one being advised, and it was so easy to tell people what they should do, isn't it? I mean, I know what people should do. So do you, right? It's too bad for all the turkeys in the other classrooms and the rest of the church and the rest of the world, right? But we know what to do, right? Yes, Mike?
Tony said before he has the gift of humility. and if you look at verse 11, this guy goes on to say, so that he sets on high those that are lowly.
Well, I was lowly, but now I'm on high, says Eliphaz, huh? Yeah. He performs wonders that cannot be fathomed, miracles that cannot be counted. That's true, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The living God does that in his mercy. He bestows rain on the earth and sends water upon the countryside. The lowly he sets on high, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. Job, too bad for you, buddy. I mean, you've lost it all. But he, here he's basically saying submit to God because things will get better through verse 16. But now Job, he thwarts, verse 12, thwarts the plans of the crafty so that their hands achieve no success. He catches the wise in their schemes and the wily are swept away. Darkness comes upon them in the daytime and at noon they grope at night. So he's presenting here that how he would do things. He would be different. And it's very interesting. When you come to chapter 42, verse 7, the roles are reversed.
Amen.
And Job is the guy in the driver's seat. And so, it's very interesting. When we pontificate to people, we can be putting ourselves in a pretty tight box.
That's right. Yeah.
I remember a very fine young man, and he really was, I'm not being facetious, he was a very fine young man. He was a youth pastor in the church that we led some years ago. And he said when his daughter grew up, she was going to be a respectful teenager. And of course, all the parents in the middle of teenagerdom were hoping that his little Megan would be a respectful teenager. But they also sensed a kind of a smug parental pride in that he's really putting his little Megan. You remember Megan, honey? Putting Megan in a pretty tight box. Now, sometimes we will receive the vice that we gave so carelessly and so comfortably and so pleasantly, years before, and we can profit from what people tell us. Other times we'll say, well, no, that was back then, but these factors are different, and we'll find enough factors to be different to explain, well, I don't have to do what I told you to do because this, this, and this. We will maneuver to not apply what we painlessly coached others to do. Are you like that, or am I the only sinner in the room? We can do that for every county. Well, let's see. So he basically is saying, if you were like me, Job, it would be really things would be better, and you'd be better off. Well, he'd pray, huh? Well, bully for him. Okay, verse 15. Are we in verse 15 yet, or 16? His goal is to say, you know, God does want to, make you better, but you know, you got to change. You got to soften. Okay. Now, 17 through 27, welcome God's correction because his purposes are positive. Verse 17, blessed is the man whom God corrects. So do not despise the discipline of the Almighty, Job. Come on now, he's for you, not against you. He's trying to help you here. He's just slapping you upside the head to get your attention here, you know. For he wounds, but he also binds up. He injures, but he also heals. In 6 calamities, he will rescue. In 7, no harm will befall you. In famine, he will ransom you from death. We have a country where food is very common. I mean, we hardly sit down any place without food. We love food. But there are places in the world where Christians are really hard-pressed.
Amen.
When we were in Iloilo, which is kind of down in the Visayas region of the Philippines, we were at a Christian school. And those kids ate 2 meals a day. Wow. There are places where people are really hungry. And this could happen to us in America tomorrow. And if so, there would be some special things that the Lord would need to do. 6 calamities he will rescue, and 7 no harm will befall you. In famine he will ransom you from death, and in battle from the stroke of the sword. What an encouragement for Christian soldiers and sailors and so forth. He will protect you from the lash of the tongue. Well, what did Elliot Bilfar think they were doing to Job right then?
Right.
And need not fear when destruction comes. Before Ceausescu was rebelled against in December of 1990 in Romania, there was a climate of fear, and everybody reporting on everybody, and just a climate of fear that was so pervasive and thick and heavy and dominating. It was terrible. Fear, not a good thing, and God says he'll protect you. You will laugh at destruction and famine. You need not fear the beasts of the earth. Well, today we have different wild animals, don't we? Although, interestingly enough, I saw a National Geographic article of a leopard just outside of Mumbai. It shows the leopard, you know, he step on one of these cameras and put the light on and snap the picture, no person there. And then in the background, the camera was set up so it would show Mumbai in the distance. So right encroaching toward Mumbai are these leopards. We have different wild animals today, don't we? Toxic waste, wild drivers, 28-year-old pickup truck mentality guys on your bumper at 73 miles an hour, you know, 15 feet off your bumper. That's one of my favorites, as Marilyn knows. Traffic, crime. We got different wild animals, but God says he'll be with us, okay? For you will have a covenant with the field and the stones of the field, and the wild animals will be at peace with you. Yes, when we're walking with God, he is many times pleased to make even the elements cooperate with us, which is what is presented in verse 23. You will know that your tent is secure and take stock of your property and find nothing missing. You'll know that your children will be many and your descendants like the grass of the earth. You will come to the grave in full vigor, like sheaves gathering in season. We have examined this, Job. We've studied this. I mean, I'm an empirical guy. I'm not a rationalist. I'm an empiricist. I believe what I see. You know, we've studied this. We've looked. We examined this. You examine. So here, apply it to yourself. Well, there's his frosty conclusion. Come on, Job. Grow up here. No more complaining. Well, that is Eliphaz's slice of the truth, and it is a true slice. And there's a quart of Eliphaz in me and thee. Much of the time, If there's an Eliphaz quoting Proverbs to us, he's going to be right. I come back to this thought, that God has incorporated in the Scriptures a book called Job to take care of that 10 or 15% of life's experiences that others cannot relate to and doesn't make sense, and they're just not there. They haven't experienced that. They're 20 years younger, and they see it much more clearly. I used to wonder when I had to attend a seminary Bible conference, some guy would get up and he'd be preaching, and 1,500 people in front of him, and he said, you know, when I was a younger man, 35, I was a lot smarter than I am today. I knew all the answers when I was 35.
Amen.
And my thought when I was 21 was, well, if you don't know as much as I know, why don't you let me preach? So I was yet to go through what he was talking about is the point. Okay. Well, anything else in chapter 5? Let's look at chapter 6. Again, I suggest to you that Will Anyone Listen is a title. You know, we want to be sympathetically understood. We hunger to be sympathetically understood, do we not?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be great if someone would come into your house and or take you out to dinner and come back there for ice cream and coffee in your house or something and sit down and say, now, tell me how it's going. And ask about 3 or 4 follow-up questions with each thing you mentioned and sit there and listen to you for 45 minutes. Wouldn't you just... That would be so wonderful, wouldn't it? And we can do that to one another. We can do that. It's not against the book. It's not against the law. We can do that. I wondered, is there a secret passageway into the hearts of people that will just build rapport? I mean, is there something that would just, you know? Yeah. And you don't have to have a PhD. Ask people how they are. And ask some follow-up questions.
And then listen.
Don't have all the answers.
Don't have all the answers. What else? Good suggestion. Listen, don't have all the answers. What else?
Don't give advice.
Don't give advice.
I think this is too quick. Just take a
listen more.
Enter into what they're going through.
Enter into. You know, even if you, let's jump to verse 14 for a second, because it's a great verse. Just a great verse. So, you'll see in the outline, there's the pain meter. We need to, science needs to establish something you can stick on your arm that would determine if Carol's migraine headaches are as bad as her neighbor's, Betty's, 2-year court case, you know. So, who's suffering the most? We need a pain meter. Then the preferred motion. He's moving toward death. That seems the way the momentum is moving toward death. But notice this profitless messengers and begins with 14. A despairing man should have the devotion of his friends, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. A despairing man should have the devotion of his friends, even if he comes to a point where he says, I don't believe in God anymore. I'm disillusioned. Forget it. I'm out of here. I've done that church thing for years. It didn't work. I'm out of here, you know? When that happens, a despairing man should have the devotion of his friends, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. Yes, Tracy.
I just like to share it in the ESV. I like how it states, he who holds kindness. You know, I understand the despairing mentality, I get it, but I love the way that it speaks. He who holds kindness. It's that if you don't do good and you know you're supposed to do it, that's it. You know?
That's right.
So the reality is that if you know somebody's hurting, we need to not withhold kindness.
Let's ask a tough question about that very thing. How much influence could Elie Bilfar have on this circumstance? Could it return those kids to him?
No.
Could it make his boils go away?
No.
Could it miraculously return his herds?
No.
Okay. The major players are Job, God, and Satan. But these three friends have got skin on. They're immediate. They're present. They're there. They can listen. They can look. They can engage. They can ask questions. They can respond. Your presence, thank you, Mike. Your presence in some room, some hospital, some situation, it says volumes.
Amen.
Just being there. If you don't feel you have all the answers, you don't have to have all the answers. Look at them, smile, and listen. Even if you totally disagree with them 100%. you can rehearse back to them what they. Let me see if I understand what you're going through. Is this happening? You've said this. Did I get that right? And you can rehearse back to them what they've said to you, even if you totally disagree. What are you doing? You're showing them respect. You're listening to them. You're building a bridge so that later, hopefully, they would be willing to listen to you when that is appropriate. Yes, sir.
Just that physical, I care for you. I'm going to help your situation. And being a spiritual friend, pray with them. Don't give them so much advice, but take them with you to the Lord.
Yes. Yes. Okay. All right. Let's see here.
You know, one thing we've learned in dealing with people from our former church, we can't teach theology in the midst of suffering. We know people that are suffering and they've been taught for decades that they shouldn't suffer. All we can do is love them, try to meet a need, comfort them. But we've had a couple situations where we tried to explain things in the midst of suffering, and that just didn't work. So we've learned that you love them, you pray for them. But it's important when we're not suffering, that's when we need to really learn our theology, and so that when we do suffer, we can deal with these situations. But again, someone who's suffering, just love them, put salve on their wounds, and pray that after this is over, God would open their eyes to proper understanding of the Scriptures.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes.
I had a devastating physical, well, I had a miscarriage when I was in my 40s, and it was pretty awful for several reasons, but anyway, I did not at that time have one lady friend who entered in and said, I didn't have anybody take me to a doctor, I didn't have anybody to... And Richard had just started at Chrysler, and they said, unless somebody dies, you can't miss any work, or you're because of the provision. And weeks later, I did have a problem out of my horrible state of mind. I didn't even think of this lovely lady, and she found out weeks later. She said, "Oh my God, if I had just known, I'd have come and cried with you." And I remember that. But I would have loved for someone to cry with me.
We need to have our antenna up. And it's very interesting. Thank you, Marta, for your honesty. Recently, a couple of individuals have said, well, I'm trying to find someone to mentor. What do you suppose I thought?
People all over
to
mentor.
Look right next to you.
Kind of do this?
See?
And the second thing I thought was, we need to build relationships before there's a crisis. Who do you turn to when there's a crisis? Someone who has cared about you before the crisis, right? If you don't have confidence that people care about you, which is expressed by interest and by discussion, by sharing, before there's a problem, you're going to turn to people that you already know. Last comment, and then we got to turn over the mic. Yes.
I was thinking something that Tony, something he said is just that you don't speak theology during the crisis. But I found that if you're living for Jesus, even through trials, that the unsaved world will come to you and ask you when they're struggling and hurting, they'll ask for prayer. Yep. They will. They'll accept it more readily.
Thank you. Thank you all. You've contributed wonderfully. Please read chapter 6 and 7. We got through 5, but we're going to try to go through 6 and 7 tomorrow or next Sunday.